Please take your Bibles and be turning with me over to the 12th chapter of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 12. I've titled my lesson tonight, Must I Spank My Child? It's been a long time since I've heard a lesson on this specific topic. We've talked about it from time to time. And some of the verses, obviously, that we'll be discussing, we've talked about in Bible classes and such. But there's a couple of things that I'm trying to do tonight. We're going to be looking at some concerns that we may have about the future as far as our freedom to serve God as God would have us serve Him. We want to try and answer the question whether or not this is something God expects us to do, commands us to do, or if it's something that's just optional on our part. And then we'll be looking at some practical aspects. We do have some young couples here tonight, and we have lots of young people, and hopefully many future families with children coming. And I hope that the things that I have to say will be of encouragement to you, as well as to all of us. I enjoyed very much the Bible class that we had in Hebrews, and we talked about this passage here in chapter 12. We learned from our study in that class that we had some brethren there that the writer of the letter was trying to deal with, Jewish brethren who were trying to escape persecution by going back to the old law. And in chapter 12, the writer deals with the example of Christ for us as far as his endurance was concerned. And beginning at about verse 3, we'll read. He says, "For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we've had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterwards, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it." What the writer is trying to express to these Christians is the fact that they should not try to escape this persecution that may be coming upon them. Even if bloodshed is involved, he calls this the chastening of the Lord. And the way he drives his point home is by using the parallel of how our earthly fathers chastened us as children. The point that I'm making from this passage is this. The Hebrew writer, by using this as an example or an illustration, is clearly showing that he affirms God's support of corporal punishment of children in the New Testament. And that's one of the things that we want to point out tonight and make sure that we're very clear about, that we understand. Another thing is that the word used here repeatedly, that word chastening, in the context is clear that what he is talking about is corporal punishment. He's talking about parents spanking their children. He's talking about the Lord inflicting physical pain on Christians because of their faith and they're willing to endure religious persecutions. But also another aspect that's important here is this passage shows how that parents, in the beginning, when children are young, stand in place of God. They learn from their relationship with their parents the relationship that hopefully they will have as they grow up with their Heavenly Father. The Bible is very clear in its teaching about chastening. Solomon has written many proverbs, well-known proverbs, 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go. When he is old, he will not depart from it. 23:13, do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, he will not die. As Christians, we're well aware of this fact. We trust in the wisdom of God to provide what's best for our children and what he teaches us. So we understand that in the Old Testament, that was very clear, that that was what was practiced. It was understood. We're going to see if that's what's expected of us today. There's a nice tract. We've got only five copies back there in the foyer right now, but it's called Discipline in the Home, and it's by Irvin Lee. I don't know if y'all are familiar with this brother. He's passed away. He and his wife have been gone for some time. They've gone to Abraham's bosom. But he was a beloved preacher in North Alabama for decades. And he wrote this along with many other things. And I'd like to read a couple of excerpts from his tract here. He says, punishment or chastening has its place as a tool for wise parents to use in nurturing their children. Many object to its use, but the Lord has always recommended it. He knows what's best. I don't think Brother Lee, having known him from my childhood, was trying to hint here or intimate that this is something that he thinks the Lord is saying is optional. But I noticed that he was careful in his wording. He says this is something that the Lord recommends that we do. He stopped a little bit short of saying that this is something that the Lord commands us to do. And that's something I want to look at and examine tonight, is whether or not that might be the case or not. Continuing in his tract, he also writes this: discipline in the home is basic and important for proper conduct at school. Good teachers would be glad if all parents were good disciplinarians. Punishment is needed to make the child recognize the parent's right to express his will. The child is not the one to take charge of things in the home. He is not the head of the family and should learn this lesson early in life. These things are true, but unfortunately, not too many teachers feel that way these days. I think Brother Lee wrote this tract probably 20, 30 years ago. But the fact is that times are changing, and they're getting difficult. I know you've heard of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, right? This is an international treaty that the United Nations wrote with many member countries who are members of the Committee on the Rights of the Child. It was issued in, it was 1989 or 90. It's over 20 years old now. By now, 193 countries have ratified this treaty. When you ratify a treaty, it becomes law in your country. Because of the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution, any treaty that the Senate ratifies in this country has priority over our own laws. The U.S. and Somalia are the only two countries that have not ratified this convention. Somalia has already gone on record by saying that it will eventually do so. 3 years ago, while speaking at the presidential youth debate at Walden University in Minneapolis, President Obama was asked if he would seek ratification of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And this is what he said. It's important that the United States return to its position as a respected global leader and promoter of human rights. It's embarrassing to find ourselves in the company of Somalia, a lawless land. I will review this and other treaties and ensure that the United States resumes its global leadership in human rights. So what's all the fuss about? What's so terrible about the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child? Well, among other things, what this treaty would make law is that children would have the ability to choose their own religion, while parents would only have the authority to give their children advice about religion. If they wanted to, they could take you to law over it. And also, parents would no longer be able to administer reasonable spankings to their children. There are those who support this convention and say, well, that's not necessarily so, but I'm going to show you evidence to the contrary that it is so. There's another group I want to talk about real quickly. It's called the Global Initiative to End All Corporal Punishment of Children. This was launched in Geneva, Switzerland in 2001. It's supported by UNICEF, members of the Committee on the Rights of the Child, various international and national organizations, including such U.S. organizations as the Presbyterian Children's Services, the Arizona Parent-Teacher Association, the National Association of School Psychologists, the National Education Association, and a lot of other people support this thing. There was a woman who was president of Ireland for 7 years. Her name is Mary Robinson. She served as the head of that government from 1990 to 1997. Immediately after she left office, she became the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights from 1997 to 2002. This is what she said of when this initiative was launched in 2001. She was there and gave a speech. And I'm just going to read some excerpts of what she said. Remember who this is. She's the United Nations, or was at the time, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Okay. He says, I am particularly sensitive to the protection of the human rights of children, and the issue of corporal punishment is one of great importance to child rights. I'm very supportive of this important initiative because I believe that physical punishment is a practice that sends the wrong message to children. It usually demonstrates the inability of adults to educate and, when necessary, discipline children by other means, such as dialogue and discussion. It also shows adult ignorance of the capacity of children to understand and distinguish right from wrong with proper guidance. The use of violence is a practice that can hamper the child's development of his or her communication ability. It can encourage aggressive behavior. It can destroy the child's self-confidence and internal value system. She goes on to say, if we want to remain faithful to the spirit of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, that's what we just talked about before, then any act of violence against him or her must be banned in accordance with Articles 19 of the Convention. Article 19, in summary, says if this convention was ratified, it would require all member states to protect children from, quote, all forms of physical or mental violence, close quote, while in the care of parents or others. The Committee on the Rights of the Child has consistently interpreted the convention as requiring states to protect children from all corporal punishment and has recommended that prohibition should be accompanied by public education to promote positive discipline. And she says that this Convention on the Rights of the Child offers valuable tools to combat corporal punishment. And she ends by saying, for all these reasons, I can assure you of my full support for such a global initiative to end all corporal punishment of children, and I wish all success to the organizers of this campaign. 30 countries have passed laws outlawing spanking your own child. In Sweden, in 1979, they passed a law banning parents from using physical punishment or any other humiliating treatment to train their children. According to the Nordic Committee on Human Rights, the Swedish courts have applied the ban broadly, criminalizing everything from slaps and spankings to timeouts and sending children to their rooms. Can you imagine that? In Canada, our neighbor to the north, spankings by parents or legal guardians, but nobody else, is still legal. But listen to this. As long as the child is not under 2 years of age or over 12 years of age and no implement other than an open bare hand is used, belts, paddles, strictly prohibited. And it said that provinces can legally impose other restrictions. Some of the other countries that have passed laws in this regard, Poland, Spain, Greece, Germany, and Israel. Now, how ironic is it that Israel would pass these laws because Israel, the keeper of the Torah, turned against their own teaching. January of 2000, the Israel Supreme Court effectively banned all parental corporal punishment, however light. One of the three judges wrote, "In the judicial, social, and educational circumstances in which we live, we must not make compromises that can endanger the welfare and physical well-being of minors. If we allow, quote, light, close quote, violence, it might deteriorate into very serious violence. We must not endanger the physical and mental well-being of a minor with any type of corporal punishment. A truth which is worthy must be clear and unequivocal, and the message is that corporal punishment is not allowed." If you live in these countries, and you're a Christian, and you spank your child, you're breaking the law. So, Somalia is fixing to pass the Convention on the Rights of the Child. It's just a matter of time before the Senate does. They say the only reason why is because of conservatives, religious conservatives, that are against the passing of it. But it's just a matter of time. When it happens, what are we as Christians to do? If we view this thing as something that's optional, that the Lord just recommends us to do, in the face like the Hebrew brethren in chapter 12, it would be very easy for us to lay aside this practice, wouldn't it? Why should I go to prison? Why should I be persecuted religiously for doing something that I don't necessarily have to do? So, when the time comes, will we have that option? Or will we, like Peter and the apostles, have to say we have to obey God rather than men? I want to show you some New Testament evidence for why I think we must spank our children, why we don't have a choice. Now, this is my opinion. You may disagree. I understand. If you think that I'm way off base or wrong or teaching error, I would ask that you come to me and tell me about that. But turn over to Ephesians chapter 6. This is a verse that's well known to us. I've heard it quoted in the auditorium here not very long ago. In Ephesians 6, beginning verse 1, we read what we've read many times before. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. That word training, King James Version says nurture. I'm going to quote some Greek words here. Sometimes, I personally feel it's necessary so that we can get straight what's going on. Paideia is the word here translated nurture. And what that Greek word means is tutorage or education. And it includes, by implication, disciplinary correction, chastening, or spanking. And I'm going to demonstrate that. Another word, the same word actually, just only a different tense, is the Greek word pahidouia. And this is the word that's used in the passage that we just looked at in Hebrews 12. Now, this is important to follow. I hope I didn't lose you on all the information that I gave you, but I wanted to express on you how dire, really, it is getting out there, okay? But over in Hebrews chapter 12, the passage that we just read, every one of those words, chasten, that we read, that I told you in the context, it was clear it was talking about spankings or corporal punishment, is this same word, pahidia. Okay, that's important. And why is it important? Because in Ephesians 6:4, we're commanded as fathers to nurture, right, our children. Something we have to do. And if it includes corporal punishment, then we have to do that too, if that is indeed part of it. These words, these two words that I just gave you, come from a root word, pahis, which is simply the Greek word for a boy. And this is interesting. I want you to catch this. The Greek word for boy, pahis, means often beaten with impunity. What? What does that mean? It was so common in Greece to beat a boy, to slap him, but that became the word for boy. Pahis comes from the word payo, which is a primary verb. It means to hit, as if by a single blow, to smite or to strike. So it's obvious in this society here, corporal punishment was very common, so common that to call a boy, you called him someone who is beaten. So we see the idea there that is even the root of the very word. Now let's look at this word. That's some pretty strong evidence right there all by itself. But how else is it used in the New Testament? Because it includes all those things that we talked about. It includes teaching, includes education, includes correction, it also includes chastening. Moses was learned in all wisdom, Acts 7:22. That's this word. Paul was taught at the feet of Gamaliel. That's this word, padahib. The grace of God teaches us to live soberly in Titus 2 and 12. But if you'll turn over to Luke chapter 23, we'll see this exact same word being used by Herod. In Luke 23, beginning in verse 16, Herod says this. Luke 23, and we're reading 16 through 22. I will therefore chastise him and release him. For it was necessary for him to release one to them at the feast. And they all cried out at once, saying, Away with this man, and release to us Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain insurrection made in the city, and for murder. Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, again called out to them, but they shouted, saying, Crucify him! Crucify him! And he said to them the third time, Why, what evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. We know what Herod meant when he used this word. He meant to scourge him. I will scourge him and release him. In 2 Corinthians 5, 4 through 10, Paul is listing some of the several ways in which he showed himself to be a minister of God. Okay? One of those ways in verse 9, he says that he was chastened and not killed. I take him as being literal there because over in 2 Corinthians 11, he talks about how that he was beaten five times with 39 stripes. So he's using this same word here to talk about the times that he was chastened. So, that's my evidence. As convincing as I hope it may be. Why is all this so important? Back to Ephesians chapter 6, verse 2. Paul, writing to the Ephesian brethren, said to them, To children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. Do you realize that Paul is lifting one of the Ten Commandments out of the Old Testament and is bringing it into his letter and is making it current? You realize that? We're often in the habit of saying what? The Ten Commandments was the covenant between God and the people of Israel, right? They don't apply to us today. Everything in the Ten Commandments that still applies to us is retaught in the New Testament. Well, here is the actual commandment lifted and brought forth. It's interesting to note, though, that he calls it the first commandment with promise. If you were to go back there and read those commandments, you'd find that this commandment is actually the fifth commandment. It happens to be the first in the list that has a promise associated with it, but I don't think that's what Paul's getting at. What do you think he means? It's the first commandment with promise. I think what it means is it's the first commandment that a child learns. And it is. The first thing as parents that we teach our children is to honor us as their parents. Right? We teach them that before they're old enough to learn anything else. And if they learn this commandment and practice it, there's a promise associated with it that it will be well with them and they may live long in the earth. Those two lines are lifting right out of the two different places where this commandment is written in the old law. Exodus 20:12, that your days may be long upon the land, and Deuteronomy 5:16 says that it may be well with you. What is one way honoring your mother and father will contribute to a long life? If you were a Jew father with a son, why would it be so important to you to begin this process of training your child from infancy? Because his physical life depended on it. Exodus 21, verses 15 and 17 says that he who strikes, if a son just struck his mother, the punishment is death. Okay? If he cursed his mother, in public, he just cursed his mother, the punishment is death. In Deuteronomy 21:18, especially, let's turn over there and look at that. What I'm doing by looking at these passages is emphasizing how important it was to a Jewish parent to exercise corporal punishment of their children. In Deuteronomy 21, we're beginning in verse 18. This is known as the law of the rebellious son. If a man is a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him, bring him out to the elders of the city, to the gate of the city, and they shall say to the elders of the city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious, he will not obey our voice, he is a glutton and a drunkard, then all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall put away the evil person from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. To strike your mother or to curse her, automatic death sentence. But in this case, just being a rebellious son with no specific sin involved other than the fact that you will not obey your parents is cause enough. That's how important it was to Jewish parents. Turn over to Romans 1. Let's look at a passage there. In Romans 1, of course, is the list of the sins that the ungodly Gentiles were guilty of, and begins in verse 28. It says that even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. And some of the most heinous crimes or sins that we know are listed here. Sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, murder, evil-mindedness, haters of God. So we see the company that's being kept here. And as we get over to the next verse, it says, verse 30, disobedient to parents. That's all it says, just disobedient to parents. What about those who were disobedient to parents? It said that those who practice such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but are also proved to those who practice them. The death, of course, that Paul is talking about is not execution. He's talking about spiritual death. Right? How much more important is our task then under the new dispensation to exercise the same care the Jewish parents did so that we can preserve the spiritual lives of our own children? Solomon, as I said, knew why children need to be chastened. Other familiar Proverbs 22:15, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of correction will drive it from him. That's an interesting statement. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. An innocent little child. If you've had children, you know they're not so innocent once they start to get older and start to exercise their stubborn self-will. If you ever had to come up against that. I think that God honestly made them that way because it would serve them well later in life, but it's very difficult for them when they're young. Proverbs 29:19 says, a servant will not be corrected by mere words, for though he understands, he will not respond. Words aren't enough sometimes, and I think that's the point of that passage. 29:15, the rod and rebuke give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. There are children sometimes that are just left to do whatever they will. And when they do, they're spoiled. They turn out rotten, don't they? How does the rod give wisdom? We'll read one more passage from Brother Lee's tract. He says, instruction is very important in training a child in the way he should go. He at first is not capable of discerning the wise from the unwise. He is brought into subjection so that he will listen, and then he can be taught. Did you catch that? And obviously he's talking about a child young enough that is not capable of discerning wise from the unwise, right? But he says, through chastening, the child can be brought into subjection so that he will listen. Why will he listen? He doesn't want to spank him. If he's trained that way, he will listen to what you have to say. And now, being subject to you, he can be taught what he might not have been able to be taught before. I'm building a case, and I know I'm preaching to the choir. Because I know most all of you are right behind me here and in agreement with me. But just in case, I have some other points that might help us. Turn over to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians 2, 5 through 8. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a servant, and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. I like the American Standard Version, because in verse 7, the ASV says, but he emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being made in the likeness of men. What is it exactly that Jesus emptied himself of? What was it? It was what he was before, right? As a divine being in heaven, he emptied himself of some of that, so that when he came to earth, he was not like that then, like he was before. I say that to lead us to Luke chapter 2. Luke chapter 2, of course, is when Jesus was taken to Jerusalem when he was 12 years old. And he stayed behind. He told his mother, because, you know, I must be about my father's business. But after they took him home, it says in verse 51 that he went down with them, came to Nazareth, and was subject to them. But his mother kept all these things in her heart. And notice verse 52. It says, and Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. It says that Jesus increased in wisdom and favor along with stature. As he's growing up, he got bigger. But his wisdom and favor increased, not just with man, but also with God. What's the implication there? The implication is, before it increased, it was less. There was a time in Jesus' younger life when he was not as wise, when he was not in as much favor as he is now at the age of 12, with man or God. And the point that Luke is making here in verse 52 is, now that he's come back to Nazareth at the age of 12, he's still not where he's going to be. He's continuing to grow in wisdom and in favor. What that tells me, and I've never really thought about this before, is that Jesus was a normal baby boy. I've often wondered about Jesus. Of course, he's my Savior. I want to know more about him. The Bible only tells me so much. I want to know everything about him. And I've wondered what his childhood was like. I know about those false gospels that said that he healed dead things, that he once picked up a dead bird that came back to life. You've ever heard that one? It's out of one of those false gospels. And I wondered, for example, how soon he came to the knowledge of who he was. But if you consider these things, it seems evident to me that as a baby, he was a baby. He wasn't God laying there, looking at his mother and father, knowing who they were, just not able to talk to them. No, he didn't know anything. His mind was empty. He was a baby. And as he grew, he became a normal toddler who did normal little boy things. Boys are boys. He had to be taught just like every other son, and being the son of a Jewish father, I have no doubt that he was chastened. Have you ever thought of that? Have you heard anybody even say or suggest that Jesus was spanked as a child? I have never heard such a thing. And you might not agree with me on that, because the scriptures don't actually tell us that. But this verse here seems to indicate the fact that he was normal just like anyone else. The point is, if Joseph spanked his son Jesus, how can we hesitate to spank our own? It was right for him, it's right for mine. Kaufman, in his commentary, I usually don't quote commentaries, but I liked what he said about this verse here. The fourfold development of Christ, mentally, physically, socially, and spiritually, is here affirmed. Exactly the type of growth and development that is inherent in the very fact of the incarnation. He who emptied himself and became a man found it needful to pass through the helplessness of infancy, the ignorance of babyhood, and the incompetence of adolescence, just like all men. The true humanity of our Lord is thus brilliantly presented by Luke, no less than his true deity. That this is the greatest mystery of all ages is a fact, but that has not prevented the full acceptance of it by the faithful of all ages. There is a lot in that verse. The difference, of course, with Jesus is that he came to full mental maturity and perfect obedience long before he reached the age where God would impute sin, what we call the age of accountability. As a baby, he was innocent. Yeah, he probably disobeyed his mother. His mother spanked him. But he didn't sin. He didn't know better. He had to be taught. But he learned obedience through the things that he suffered. And that's what we learn. Let's look at Hebrews chapter 5. Try to move right along here. Hebrews 5, 5 through 9. So also Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he who said to him, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." And he also says in another place, "You are priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek." Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and was heard because of his godly fear, though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. Of course, this is the adult man, Jesus. And I think he's talking about the garden. Jesus, according to the Hebrew writer, begged God the Father with strong crying and tears to not have to face the death on the cross. He poured himself out and begged him for this. And his father said no. He learned obedience, or demonstrated his obedience, by going through and suffering that death on the cross. Okay. First as a child, now here in this passage as the Savior of the world. Question. If God can say no to Jesus when he's begging for his life, can we say no to a child who's begging for or demanding a toy in the store? Who's just crying his little eyes out? Please, mommy, let me have this. It's so tempting to give in. It's a lot easier to let them have their way. Because they'll be quiet then, won't they? For a little while. Children must learn submission, respect. They must learn to ask permission politely without expectation of receiving. To not back talk, not to argue their case. And finally, when they've got their answer, to conceal their disappointment if the answer was no. They must learn this as soon as possible. That's a lot to learn. How do they do it? The way they do it is by their parents teaching them, explaining to them, trial and error, correction, and chastening. All those things that I just said, remember, were the definition of the word paideia in Ephesians 6:4, raising up a child in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Jesus demonstrated his obedience by willingly submitting to the suffering of the cross. We've just seen from the passage we read that he did not want to do it. The man, Jesus, did not want to do it. Okay? Jesus, the Word, Jesus, who was God, had a part in formulating the plan of salvation. But as man, he did not want to face the death. He begged for a way to be found. He sought to escape from it. But, and this is very important, I want you to catch this, he was not forced to do it. Could God have forced Jesus to have submitted? Of course he could. He could have forced him, but he didn't. If he had forced him against his will, it would not have been obedience, right? He must have had the choice to run away if he wanted to, and he did. Had he ever run away before? Yes, he did. There was one time when he was in the temple, John 8, and he was talking to the crowd. And this is the time that he said, "Most assuredly I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." That was not lost on them. They didn't have to be told what that meant like we have to be told. They knew he was claiming deity when he said, "I am." What did they try to do? Tried to stone him. What did Jesus do? Just slipped away. He was right in front of them. They were picking up stones to stone him. And he just slipped away right out from underneath their noses. I believe that was a miracle, because it was not his time. Matthew 26, in the garden, when Peter cut off the ear of Malchus, Jesus said to him, "Or do you think that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels?" That's an interesting statement, because he says, if I pray to him, he will provide. You ever thought of that? Jesus said, "God will give me the angels. All I have to do is ask for them." Of course, I will have failed and there would be no salvation. But all I have to do is ask. But he said, no. Our children learn to obey us by the chastening that they suffer. If we physically constrain them, force them to comply, they do not demonstrate obedience, since we've taken away their choice. They have to do it by choice. Okay. Let's start to wind up. When and how do we do this? When do we start? That's a pretty important question. We should start when he's a child, before he's old. Isn't that what Proverbs 22:6 says? Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart of it. So we're talking about children here. Okay? How young a child? We should start while there is still hope. Proverbs 19:18 says, "Chasten your son while there is hope. And do not set your heart on his destruction." If you wait too long, there may not be hope. It doesn't matter how much you beat him. You have to start young. Mary Robinson was wrong. Remember what I read she said? If we wait until our children are old enough to have a dialogue and a discussion with them, until they're old enough to understand and distinguish between right and wrong, then we've waited too long. At that point, he considers himself your equal. And he can just ignore whatever you say, if he wants to. And if you think to start spanking him then, well, you may just alienate yourself from your son. Because now, he's big. And he says, "I don't need you." But when he's little, you're God to him. You're his whole world. And he knows that he needs you. So how do we know? You know, the scriptures don't tell us. We've got a lot of information tonight. But the way we learn is the way that the women, the young wives in Titus learn. You look over at Titus chapter 2. Verse Verse 3 talks about the older women likewise, that they should be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. What is Paul telling Titus? He's saying you need to teach the older women to teach the younger women how to be good mothers, how to love their husbands, how to love their children. Now, I can see loving the husband part. That can be pretty difficult sometimes. But as a mother, what mother doesn't love their child? Isn't that natural? Isn't that a given? Haven't we seen pictures of mother eagles, you know, with their wings spread over their young and being burned to death while they protect their brood from the fire? Wouldn't any mother be that way? Well, sure, but she loves in a different way than they need to be taught to love. She may think that it will hurt them if I spank them. I can find a less violent way to train them. And the older sister can say, no, this is what you need to do. This is when you need to start. And this is how you need to do it. And if you'll do it this way, you will succeed because that's what works. Of course, this, even though it doesn't say that about the men, the same would apply for the men as well. God leaves the particulars up to us. We have to learn by trial and error. I'm going to close with some personal advice. I have a golden opportunity to give unasked for advice. I'd be interested to know those of you who have gone through this process and navigated these waters, if this is how you did it or not. First of all, begin when your child is very young. Do not wait. 6 months is not too early. You might get someone telling you, that's just wrong. Don't spank that baby, but it works. If the baby won't lie still or tries to roll over while you're changing the diaper, slap her on the leg. She won't know what you're doing. But you know what she'll do? She'll associate that sting on her leg with what she's doing. And if you're consistent, she will stop. Donna got one of our five-month-olds to quit rolling over just by slapping her leg. If she bites you while you're nursing, slap that leg every time. And she will stop biting you. It works. Start right away. Okay? I'm not talking about a newborn. Talk about an infant, though. I'm talking about a baby long before she started to talk, long before she started to walk. Okay? But you need to start then. As a babe in arms during the worship service, this has worked for me. She will eventually attempt to assert her will and maybe even pitch a fit time to time. Now, I'm talking about a baby who can't stand up yet. Take her outside. Don't take her to the nursery. Take her outside, slap her on the leg, and bring her back in and sit down. If she does it again, get right back up, go right back outside, and slap that leg again, and come back in and sit down. This is the battle of wills, and it starts young. And if you don't win, she will, and you will have lost the battle. And that's where it starts. And you've got to continue. You've got to be consistent. Don't take her to the nursery to play. This is not playtime. This is serious business. You young people who have children in your future, remember what I'm saying. You go in there and let her play, and she'll know to misbehave next time because now we can go to the nursery and play. Child can't even talk yet, and she's learned that. Number two, be consistent. Do not give in. It will take time and lots of patience, but it will work. You're the mom. You're the dad. Number three, there will be a contest of wills. This was the hardest thing for me to have to do. And as far as I know, I had to do with just about every one of my daughters. I don't know how one or two of them escaped, but they did. When your child gets to be about 2 years old, and I'll pause it, we're getting a little long, but this is good stuff. I should have come with this up front. When they get to be about 2 years old, they will assert that self, that independence, that stubborn streak, that will that will conflict with yours. You need to be testing that. And you want to get this handled early so it won't scar them for life, because this is bad. You're going to ask her to come to you one day. She's going to be standing on the other side of the room. And you're going to say, "Caroline, come here." She's going to look at you and ignore you. And you know what you're going to do? You're not going to say, "Oh, that's okay." You've lost. What you're going to do is you're going to go over there, pick Caroline up, bring her back to where you were sitting, and light her little legs on fire. Then you're going to pick her up, take her back over there, set her down, go back to your chair, and then what are you going to say? "Caroline, come over here." You know what? She's not going to. You know why? Because you're into the contest now. This is it. This is like, you know, high noon or the OK Corral. All right? If you lay down now, you've lost. Go over there, pick her up, bring her back over, do the same thing. Take her back, call her to you. You may have to do this 3, 4, 5 times. You'll get to the point where it's just breaking your heart. This is killing you to have to do this to this child. Is this child abuse what I'm doing? You know, switch legs if you have to. But do what you got to do. You've got to get that child to come to you. And once she's come to you, now she is yours. She has submitted to you, and you can train her from then on. You still have to spank her, but you've got to do it. And I'd be curious to hear if y'all have ever gone through this, but it's worked wonders with my daughters. Have specific spanking rules. Reserve spanking for certain things in our house. Biting, hitting, lying, and willful disobedience were always corrected with a spanking. It doesn't matter if you confessed it. You could come to me and confess, "I did this, and I'm sorry." You still got the spanking. And it was an event. You appreciate the fact. Number 5, be fair. Hear out your child. There may be some circumstances you're not aware of. Sometimes I could have used Nero Wolf trying to figure out what actually happened. This one says one thing and that one says another, and it gets to the point where you just don't know what to do and you have to let it go. Somebody got away with something. But you can't punish the wrong one. You've got to be sure that you're punishing the right one. Never spank unless you're convinced. Number 6, never, ever spank when you're angry. Remember that. If you're angry, wait. Send the child to the room. Do whatever you got to do until your emotions are under control. Then, when you go to see them, and it's time, talk, then spank. Some of the worst spankings I got when my dad sat down with me and talked to me first. Just spank me, let's get it over with. And because he would explain to me why he's doing it, that he loved me, that it was hurting him more than it was hurting me. And you've got to do that because that's part of it. They need to know why you're doing it. And afterwards, wait until they come to you in penitence. You do not show any affection at all after the spanking. You let them come to you and tell you you're sorry, then you can show affection. Number 8, always use your hand on their bottom so you can tell how hard you're spanking them. Make it hurt. It's supposed to hurt. Spank them through their pride. Some little boys are tough. That's why you begin early. You know, when a little boy gets older, he will not show that it's hurting. It's that stubborn boyish pride. He won't cry. He won't whimper. And you can beat him and thrash him. And it's because you waited too long. You do it when he's a little boy. You won't have to do it later when he's a bigger boy. Okay? Be careful with the belts and switches. They can leave welts and bring blood. If you do that to your child, they will not understand what you're doing. I used a switch from a privet hedge one time. I was careful to take all the leaves off. Still brought blood. I even practiced on my own leg first to make sure that I wasn't hitting too hard. Your hand is the best. Your goal is to be done with spanking for the most part by the age of 5 or 6. What? Is that even possible? Yes, it is possible. If you'll start at 5 months and be consistent, you can have your child in subjection by the time they're 5 or 6, and then just kind of mop up a little bit after that. My goal was always to get to the point where my daughters wouldn't remember what they had to go through. But what they remembered is that they respected and honored me and obeyed me and did whatever I told them to do. Thank you so much for your patience. I didn't have time to go through this. I wrote. I had a feeling it would be a little long. And I hope it was worth it. I want to close with one passage. There's a lot of other stuff I'd like to have talked about. The fact that the Lord chastens us.